Nevin Campanella, welcoming you to the VBS production of Woodland Star, your net radio source for entertainment and coincidental enlightenment. We are starting a little bit late this afternoon, folks, so bear with us. We are getting our act together. And along with a number of other people who have to get their act together, as in Frodo. Yeah, friends, Frodo is crossing the Misty Mountains, and our guest today will be Dr. Amy H. Sturgis. Now, Dr. Sturgis will give us some insight into the work of J.R. Tolkien and Frodo's journey across the Misty Mountains. If you have some questions, you can call us at our toll-free number, which is 888-228-4494. Now, folks, that's good for both the USA and Canada. We also have a worldwide number of 877-489-6350. So let's get started, and let's get Dr. Sturgis on board. Dr. Sturgis, are you there?
I'm right here.
Wonderful. How was your day today?
Very good, thank you. I'm pleased to be a part of your program this afternoon.
Oh, fantastic. Dr. Sturgis, before we get into a discussion about Tolkien and all the wonderful work that he did, how about giving us a little bit of background on yourself? You know, such as who are you, why are you, where did you come from, where did you go to school, and all that good stuff.
Certainly. I grew up in Tulsa and Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, and I moved to Nashville, Tennessee for my undergraduate and graduate training. I got my PhD at Vanderbilt University, and while I was in Nashville, I met my husband, Dr. Larry Hall. We now live in North Carolina. I grew up both interested in history, coming from Oklahoma. There was a rich cultural history there to learn about, and deeply influenced also by speculative fiction. I read Ray Bradbury and Frank Herbert and Robert Heinlein, as well as J.R.R. Tolkien, and as I grew older, H.P. Lovecraft and others. I later realized that history and speculative fiction, science fiction and fantasy, really were two sides of the same coin, both asking the question of what it means to be human, just looking in different directions for the answer. And so I went into intellectual history, or the history of ideas, so I could divide my time between science fiction and fantasy studies and Native American studies in my teaching, writing, and research. And really, my professional life is a story of finding a balance between the natural bookworm in me who wants to know more and my inner six-year-old who wears Chewbacca knee socks and carries a lightsaber. It's a good life.
Well, what you have talked about in terms of what you were interested in, it's not only a past record, but an awful lot of the work that had been written was predicting a future record. If we look at, H.G. Wells, for instance, many of the authors that you brought up were, in fact, predicting what might lie ahead. So I guess maybe that's why there is that term intellectual history. Well, yeah, it's rather amazing that, historically these people were predicting the future. Now, let's get down to the business of the day. Let's start with why your particular interest in Tolkien as an author. I mean, what was it about Tolkien that attracted you, and when did this occur?
I read Tolkien as a child. I remember my grandfather gave me my first copies of Tolkien, and he, in fact, told me that they were great stories, and he loved them when he was young. And then my grandmother responded saying, oh, this is too old for her to be reading. There's all sorts of violence and monsters and terrible things happening, and she's too young for that sort of thing. And, of course, that instantly meant that I had to read all of these books. It was great reverse psychology. But I think not only the great storytelling ingredients that the Tolkien used and his ability to put them together moved me, but also the sense of history around them. He was really crafting stories from centuries-old building blocks. And every time I reread his work, I see something again that speaks to the human condition. When he was writing one of his letters to one of his correspondents and was asked what the whole Middle Earth cycle was about, he said really he could narrow it down to three things, the fall, mortality, and the machine. And if you think about those three things, the fall, in a sense, the idea that we've been sundered from something, that we need redemption of some kind. Mortality, the fact that we're not infinite.
Go ahead and continue, Amy.
All right. And the machine, if you think of the machine in terms of war, or if you think of it in terms of the way modern technology is related to nature, for example, industrialism versus the environment, all of these things are as relevant today as when Tolkien was writing about them. And I think that's what brings us back to the texts over and over again. Certainly, it's what brings me back, the fact that these themes are universal and the fact that they continue to speak to us in our present condition.
Well, now, Tolkien himself has a war record. As I understand it, he served some time in the military. I always kind of wondered if his military experience may have generated some of the fictional work, especially regarding the trilogy. What is your opinion?
Oh, I think it definitely did. In fact, at one point he said that you can't really understand Frodo's final journey in Mordor to destroy the ring and the sort of desolation he encountered unless you'd been on the field during the war. And I think his understanding of the hobbits as the common people who had to step forward and really assume responsibility for saving civilization as they knew it was also tied to his war experience. And even some of the beautiful love stories that come out of Tolkien, for example, it's alluded to in The Lord of the Rings, certainly told in full in The Silmarillion, the story of Beren and Lúthien. He began writing after he'd been parted from his new wife going to the front during the war. He began writing the story about the mortal man who loved the immortal woman and feared he'd never see her again as he went off to war. And so I think the idea of both the mortality aspect and the machine aspect are completely tied up in the war experience.
Well, the book itself that you're bringing up, The Silmarillion, was actually written after, or at least put together, after the trilogy. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Actually, the texts that comprise The Silmarillion, many of them were written first, before either The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings. But the final book together was published posthumously when his son, Christopher Tolkien, put his notes together. Essentially, he wanted to write a mythology for England, and he kept trying to put these stories together, and he kept tinkering with them for decades and decades. After The Hobbit did so well, the publishers asked for a sequel, and he tried to sell them on The Silmarillion, and they said, no, there are no hobbits in that. We want a hobbit story. And so he wrote The Lord of the Rings. But the long-term project of his life, really, was The Silmarillion. So it began before his other Middle Earth works, but yet wasn't even published at the time of his death. It's a very interesting story how all of those texts came together in that way.
Yeah, I guess, as a reader, we don't really know all the little intricacies that took place in terms of publication. So you wind up making some assumptions that are wrong. For instance, one assumption would have been by many people, well, the Silmarillion was an afterthought after The Hobbit and after the trilogy, which in fact it wasn't. It was probably part of his basic notes to begin with. And now hearing what you just said about not actually being able to get it published because it didn't have hobbits, now it's starting to put things, it's starting to sound a little bit more rational as to what actually occurred. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. It also explains the fact that, for example, there are hundreds of references in The Lord of the Rings in one way or another to texts that are in the Silmarillion, except, of course, for many years, readers of The Lord of the Rings didn't have the Silmarillion to go to to follow up on those references.
Well, to get us a little bit more acquainted now with the work of Tolkien, why don't you give the audience, and take as much time as you want, a synopsis of the Silmarillion, and what was it about, who was in it, what was it going to do?
Well, it was a series of stories that are loosely connected in the history of Middle Earth ages before the age in which The Hobbit and The Lord of the Ring take place. And really, it begins, if you want to think of it in terms, biblical terms, with Tolkien's Old Testament, his creation story, how the world came into being. And so he tells this grand metaphorical story of how Middle Earth was created, how existence was sung into being, how all of the powers came into harmony and then ultimately disharmony. Once this grand vision is set up, then it's the story of how the different creatures came to be. So you have elves and men and dwarves, etc. And a discrete set, then, of stories about some of the great heroes of the early ages, and also how Middle Earth changed before the Middle Earth that we know in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. For example, how humans came to have mortality, how the elves were eventually sundered from the great promise that they had because of their rebellion, how the race that would end up being the race of Aragorn were in fact punished for trying to get immortality for themselves. We essentially learn how Middle-earth that we recognize from The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit came into being. And in the midst of this, you have some fantastic stories. For example, the story of Beren and Lúthien, the mortal man who loves the immortal elf. You have a story of Turin Turambar, which has now become its own work, The Children of Húrin, which recently came out, also edited by Christopher Tolkien, which is the story of a great tragic hero, an epic story on the scale of Beowulf or any of the Arthurian stories, really gripping individual episodes in this larger story of how we come to find Middle Earth the way it is, the rebellion of Melkor, who we will eventually see then as the power behind Sauron in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Really, we see all of this come together, and his overarching goal in stringing these stories together and telling this large epic story was to create a mythology that would unite people. He saw the kinds of national tales that other cultures had. He saw, for example, the way the Icelandic sagas gave a unique history and grounding and flavor to the Icelandic culture. He read works like the Kalevala and fell in love with these kinds of myths. And he felt that England really didn't have that kind of thing. Even the Arthurian stories had become, you know, partially influenced by the French and by other groups. And he wanted something that was truly really English. And so...
Okay, let me stop you at that point.
Yes.
Let's get down to the nitty-gritty of truly the English, Celtic, if you will, point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the things that he refers to appear to me to come out of myth and lore from far beyond the British Isles.
Very true.
You know, I mean, he pulled in concepts, entities that, you know, they weren't known worldwide until Tolkien set on the scene. But I guess in my own mind, Dr. Sturgis, I don't really believe that Tolkien created the characters and their background out of nothing, that he actually went into the lore of the planet itself and pulled from different cultures.
That was his genius, because he wanted something that could be essentially a gift to his nation, and yet he, in order to create this, he borrowed from every great storytelling tradition in the world. He, in his great essay on fairy stories, which he wrote in 1947 and is, I think, the best thing he ever wrote, I just love this essay, he talks about the cauldron of story, that there are great ingredients in there, and when people get so fascinated with where all the ingredients came from, they forget to ask, does the soup taste good? And he wanted to make a soup that tasted good, so he went and found the best ingredients. And so you're exactly right. For example, if you read in Norse literature the Eddas, you find Gandalf, named Gandalf. You find Gimli and Gloin and all of the dwarf names. You find all sorts of archetypal stories, including if you go through the Siegfried legend, you have the horde that is protected by the dragon with you know, the golden... a ring. You have all sorts of things that he pulled from world mythology. And because he was a student of language, and because he was a student of literary history, he had essentially a global palette on which to draw to create something then that he could internalize and give back in a form that he thought would speak particularly to his countrymen. Although, of course, he also wrote that he wanted to invite other artists, other people with other hands and with other voices to be a part of the Middle-earth cycle. So even as he wanted something that was English, he was already thinking that, that there would be other voices that would lend their own interpretation of the mythos he created in the same way that he was essentially adding his own voice to stories that had already existed.
Well, the English literature society didn't always accept him. I mean, when a lot of things that actually occurred to him, I mean, I guess I should say that intelligentsia somewhat condemned him. He was loved by everybody else, but it seems to me that the some of the people around that area, you know, English literature and so on and so forth, were actually throwing rocks at him, but I never could understand why.
You're definitely correct on that point. I think a couple of things were working against him. One is that any kind of imaginative fiction, genre fiction, be it fantasy, science fiction, horror, has inherently had a difficult time in the academy, being marginalized in one form or another, particularly because of what Tolkien called the accident of history, having these things in very recent times, you know, 19th century and after, linked with childhood in a way that they never had been before. Fairy stories were not just for children in previous centuries, but they had somehow gotten that stigma that they weren't for grown-ups then. But there's also, I think, an inherent bias against things that are popular, which is ironic since, for example, Shakespeare was considered to be, entertainment for the garish masses and seen as being very vulgar in its time and very commonplace. But things that sell well, that have good reactions are seen, unfortunately, many times as low culture. And so if it's popular, it must be bad. I mean, we have that today. You have people like Harold Bloom still writing that, still writing not only against Tolkien, but phenomena like J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series, not on their literary merits, but on the fact that they sell well. And since at the height of his popularity, Tolkien was inspiring artists and visual artists, musicians. I mean, the Beatles wanted to make a movie based on The Lord of the Rings. You can't get any more popular than that.
No, you can't. And I suspect, at least my own suspicion, is that an awful lot of the things that are being, that were tossed at him from the literary society, a lot of it had to do with plain old envy. I mean, the man was actually getting published. And there's a lot more writers than there are publications. So, I suspect that just plain old envy has had a lot to do with it.
Right.
You know, when it comes to trying to fathom someone like Tolkien is certainly beyond me, because I know that with even my own little bit of experience around writing, how difficult it is to, you know, to work through a story theme. But we're talking about an individual who didn't just create a story theme, he created an entire history, including languages and poetry. And I mean, my God, the amount that went into it, which reminds me, before I forget, how long do you think it took from, and I know it's hard to separate out, but some roundhouse figures, how long do you think it took to put from The Hobbit to the trilogy, how long do you think it took to put all that together?
Oh, goodness. Well, it took him 17 years just from The Hobbit to finish the trilogy. And that's not the time it took to write The Hobbit as well. So you're looking at a couple of decades of work just in those four books.
And isn't it true that he had friends and family that would review his work and he would make corrections in different editions? Is that correct or not?
Yes, absolutely. And, in fact, one of his earliest readers was the son of one of his publishers, who was essentially given candy money to read The Hobbit and write a review. And he wrote a little review that he thought that the children would love The Hobbit and here were the good things about it. And he got, you know, a little spending money in order to give his opinion on the book. But his children read it. He worked things in for his children. His friends wrote it. And he also went back and revised. For example, before the Lord of the Rings trilogy came out, he went back and revised certain aspects of The Hobbit to make, for example, the whole interaction between Bilbo Baggins and Gollum a little more threatening, to give a bit more foreshadowing that actually the ring was a very important thing that had a negative impact that would come back to haunt all of the characters. So he was essentially a lifelong tinkerer and fiddler, and that's why we didn't get the Silmarillion, for that matter. He kept going back and changing things, and we're lucky that we got what we did when we did, because, it took him 17 years just to write The Lord of the Rings.
Can you imagine yourself taking on that type of task? I mean, the motivation that would be required, where would it come from? Where did he get it?
Well, I think for him it began with the love of language. He was making imaginary languages for himself while he was still a school child, and his vision was to create a world in which these languages could be spoken, and from the languages came everything else. And so essentially you have Elvish. That is the first drop in the bucket, and then from that comes an entire ocean. I can't imagine the project of world building that was involved, though, because so many different aspects of the world, from geography to architecture to terminology to lifestyle, were so well-researched and based on so many, as you pointed out before, ingredients from other cultures, other stories, other histories. It was a multidisciplinary task of just remarkable scale. And I can't imagine creating all of that out of nothing and then producing something that feels so genuine and so so long-lived and already so ancient when it's, you know, right out of the mind of the creator. So authentic. It's truly just a remarkable achievement. And others who have done amazing jobs, whether it's Lewis's Narnia or Rowling's Wizarding World or many other authors I could name, even though they've done really remarkable jobs, it's just not comparable to the scale and the depth with which Tolkien did this.
Oh, it's not only not comparable, but I don't know of any other author that stimulated a continuation of adult fantasy as much as he did. You know, when my first encounter with Tolkien was 1962. I was, 19 or 20 years old, a college freshman, and I was handed my a copy of The Hobbit, and I was hooked. I mean, from day one. And you know, having been around, you know, as a 60s youngin and all the sit-ins and everything else, I can tell you that. There wasn't a time that went by, no matter what commune I visited or whatever, that Tolkien and The Hobbit didn't come up. I mean, it seemed like they were trying to literally live the fantasy that Tolkien had created on paper. And today, to this very, I have no idea how many copies I have been through. I mean, from rereading and rereading and rereading. And you brought up a really interesting point that, you know, the work never gives out. It seems so real and so timeless that you wind up reading it almost as a, how should I say this, a form of relief from current day events. In other words, no matter how bad the day gets, no matter what goes on in your life, no matter how crazy things are, you know, you, at night you can kind of curl up on the couch and open up The Hobbit. And it kind of makes everything better.
Well, and that fits back beautifully with Tolkien's essay on fairy stories, because in a sense, Tolkien explains what this kind of great literature does, and then he went out and he did it. In on fairy stories, he says that these kinds of tales are important. For young people, also for adults, they're life-changing in their importance because they give us gifts like fantasy, being able to see a separate world, like recovery, getting to step out of our own world and then look at our world with new eyes when we get back there, escape, as you just mentioned, getting to step beyond the petty concerns that grind us down and have that sense of renewal from just the opportunity to step away from them. And also consolation, that joyous turn of what he called the eucatastrophe, the happy ending that's unlooked for, that's almost as poignant as grief. And he said those gifts we need, like food. And so the stories that give us these gifts we'll keep going back to again and again. And I think that's exactly what Tolkien's work provides.
Oh, absolutely. And one, I think one of the things, sadly, that happened historically is when written language came on the scene and became such an integral part of everyone's culture, the storytelling part took a back seat. Which was unfortunate. I mean, even in the Native American culture, we have, for instance, the storytelling dolls, where you see portrayed the mother with all the infants around her and telling the rich history of their own culture. But you know, the same thing does occur, but people don't look at it this way. And that is, you have, for instance, especially around the holidays, adults will gather children gather along with them. They sit around the holiday table, whether it's Hanukkah, whether it's Christmas, whatever it is, it's almost a guarantee that a story, a historical part of that family is going to come up, and pretty soon the room goes quiet and everybody's listening to the story of Uncle Bill and how he did such and such. You know, somewhere along the line at the broader macro level of society, we seem to have poo-pooed all that in favor of the written words. And maybe we need to get back to that. Maybe that is something that maybe we're missing a little bit.
I think there's definitely something to that. And I think there's also a lot of ways that our society is trying to find new ways of filling that old hunger. I would suggest, for example, podcasting is one of those things.
Yes.
You know, new outlets that technology has made available where we're wanting to listen to things and then be interactive about them, talk back, and be participants in storytelling. Even the phenomenon of fan fiction, which I've done some work on, both in the realm of Tolkien and in other storytelling formats, where people want to not only just consume something, but want to be a part of a storytelling experience and add their voice and then turn around and become storytellers themselves. Tolkien calls this becoming sub-creators, fact that we are created beings, in our nature we want to be creators ourselves, and so we do. And I think that's the part of the storytelling, the part of the oral culture, the part of wanting to step inside the story and then to give the story to someone else. That's definitely, I think, an intrinsic part of our humanity.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've been trying to convince the BBS production company to initiate a net radio hour, you know, as in old-time radio with stories, plays, so on and so forth. Well, yeah, the idea sounds wonderful to me, but I haven't been able to convince anyone yet.
Well, good luck.
Well, I think part of the problem, you know, Dr. Sturgis, people get caught up in the dramatic now, such as the elections, the pain of war, those kinds of things. And somehow we seem to do really well at listening to pain and suffering and the news event of the day, but we don't do very well at playing. And that is something that I think that net radio might be useful for in teaching people how to play a little bit and play along. Matter of fact, BBS radio is about to dive into interactive net radio, and it's a perfect format for what we're talking about, but as of yet, I haven't been able to convince anyone. Well, let's get on to the story itself and some of the characters. One of the very first ones that comes to my mind is Smeagol. Here we have another name, Gollum, as maybe people are more familiar with that term. We actually have an almost Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde situation with Smeagol. I mean, at one time, we have a character who was almost Hobbit-like, but then physically he changes over time. Could you discuss Smeagol a little bit and how you think Tolkien saw his part in all of this?
Yes. You're right, I think, in calling him a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde kind of character. We really see the doomed character who clearly has made the wrong decisions and is part of, to go back to the three themes I mentioned previously, part of the fall. He has fallen, and in a way he can't get up because of the choices he has made. And yet there is this desire for redemption in him. And even in this character that seems to be the lowest of the low, there is this internal struggle, not wanting the ring to get into the wrong hands, wanting to identify with Frodo and appreciating Frodo. I think the thing that fascinates me most about Gollum or Smeagol is, actually, in a way, more about Bilbo, and that is the question of mercy. Because when we first see him in the cave, when Bilbo first gets the ring, it seems ideal for Bilbo to just go ahead and kill him, make sure that that isn't a loose thread that comes back and bites him later. There seems to be no redeeming trait about him. And yet he takes pity on him because he is such a fallen creature. Like, if you want to go into Tolkien's personal theology and his understanding of the world, like we all are. And so there's this moment where Bilbo, you know, his hand is stayed and he doesn't strike Gollum. And then you see all this time later, by the end of The Lord of the Rings, and when this character has become increasingly divided and you see the struggle increasingly clearly, and we see, in a sense, part of Smeagol in Frodo, as Frodo is overtaken by the ring. At the last minute, Frodo is unable to dispense with the ring. He's going to claim it. He's going to fall prey to it, just as other characters have previously. And it's that moment of mercy, unlooked for, that comes back once again. The fact that Bilbo did not strike makes Gollum the instrument of everyone's redemption. Gollum doing what Gollum does, which in the end is also acting for the ring, for power, for his own self-interest, still works for the greater good because of that thread of mercy. And I think Tolkien felt incredibly empathetic toward Smeagol. You have the moment where he watches Frodo sleeping, and he remembers what it was like to be innocent in that way and wishes he could be that way again. You have these moments where he almost turns, and I think, in a sense, Tolkien saw himself and saw all of us, the human condition, in this fallen creature, and the fact that he could be used ultimately for saving Middle-earth by being the one who inadvertently, true, but still the only one who could, destroy the ring, really tells us a lot about Tolkien's hopefulness in the face of what really is a very bleak picture of the fallen nature of humanity.
Oh, absolutely. And I think Tolkien was giving us a lesson, and that is, don't kill off all the parts, because you don't know what role all these parts will play, even in your own life. And, you know, you're bringing up the vital essence of the entire book, which is, if Smeagol had been killed by Bilbo, then the ring could never have been destroyed. I mean, what we have at the end is a sheer accident. In other words, Smeagol jumps for the ring, bites off the finger, and falls into the abyss. Without that, there would have been no Middle Earth. It would have been taken over.
Right.
So right from the very beginning, and I think wasn't there a part in the book where I think it was Gandalf kind of chastising Frodo a little bit, because Frodo was saying, why didn't he kill him?
Exactly.
And Gandalf says to him, hey, wait a minute, you know, we don't know who should live and die.
That bit of humility coming from Gandalf really says something too.
Well, now, when we get to, there are certain parts of the book that I have favorite parts. I imagine everyone has a little favorite character, a little favorite part.
Yes.
And the recent introduction of Hollywood and the Hobbit, the trilogy, I got to tell you, for me, it was a bit of a disappointment. And I guess it's because I have read the book so many times, you know, and your own imagination eventually takes over, and I guess Hollywood can never match what your own imagination can do, or certainly not something that Hollywood could ever do.
Right.
There is a part that seemed to me to be strangely missing in the Hollywood production, and that is Tom Bombadil and Goldberry. You know,
yes.
I got to tell you the truth. When the movie first came out, I was very excited. And I think it was right like, it was just like right around a Christmas time of some sort when it first came out. And we, because of where we were living, which was a very isolated area in the mountains of New Mexico, we had to travel a great distance to go to a movie house to see the movie. And so, of course, my wife and I were both very excited. And I was so disappointed, I actually walked out of the movie.
Oh.
Yeah, I did. I was, you know, I mean, I eventually, years later, I did catch up on all of it, but I was so disappointed because it just did not come close to what I considered Tolkien's work. So tell me, why, first of all, why do you think Tom Bombadil was left out of the movie?
Well, I think a lot of people have difficulty in determining where he fits in the story. He's one of my favorite characters. I'm a Tom Bombadil fan. And I must say, just as an aside, I guess it was summer before last, I saw the Lord of the Rings, the musical in Toronto before it left to go to London. And there was a point towards the end where they mentioned Tom Bombadil in a very clear aside to the audience. And you'll be pleased to know there was applause and spontaneous acts of joy that someone remembered Tom Bombadil. He worked in some way, even though there was a musical that tried to do all three books in 3 hours. They still managed to mention Tom Bombadil. But I think in terms of just movie making, they were trying to find a way to condense the story. And I think there were things Jackson did well, and I think there were things Jackson did poorly. But in just terms of storytelling, Bombadil has been excerpted before. He was excerpted in the previous film. He was excerpted in the outstanding BBC radio drama of The Lord of the Rings, although they did actually do the part of Tom Bombadil, and they released it separately so that it, those who wanted to hear the entire Lord of the Rings dramatization could have the Tom Bombadil scenes as well. But I think just in terms of cinematic storytelling, they were looking for ways to condense. I think it's a really integral part of the story.
Absolutely. I mean, Tom Bombadil represents the absolute mystery of creation itself. In the end, no matter how many times you read about Tom Bombadil, it's going to be very difficult to understand what is he, why is he, when was he. But maybe you could address that a little bit for the audience listening. Who was Tom Bombadil, and what role did he have to play?
Well, if I answer this too definitively, I will talk my students out of their papers because in my university course on J.R.R. Tolkien, this is a very favorite research project topic. But in terms of the story, Tom comes along at a very important part. You have the hobbits just leaving the Shire on their way. They've all four of them have committed to be on this task to do whatever is necessary to get the ring out of the Shire. But they are really innocents, and they're just beginning to realize what an incredible threat and danger they've taken on themselves in this quest. And there's this moment of oasis when they find Tom Bombadil and his wife, Goldberry. And first of all, they meet him because Bombadil rescues them, because he can actually talk to the trees. You have this really dark wood, forbidding forest. You realize there you have a foreshadowing of the Ents, the fact that the trees are alive and they do have a stake in the story of Middle-earth, and they can fight and retaliate. But he's older than everything else. He knows the songs that speak to nature. His tail is older. and his knowledge is deeper, and he's able to convince the forest to let them go. And taking them to his house, they have this respite where they have incredibly prophetic dreams. This ties into the whole fact that The Lord of the Rings is really a medieval work based on medieval storytelling that has all sorts of really interesting ways of getting the idea across, one of which is dream sequences. And all of the hobbits have very important dreams, particularly Frodo in Tom Bombadil's house. But they also discover that even though it seems like this ring is the biggest thing ever and their peril is the most dire thing in Middle-earth, that it has no power over Tom Bombadil, that he's really thinks of it almost in terms of a joke, that there is something older and more lasting and untouchable by this present evil that exists in Middle-earth. And in a sense, I think that goes back to those three points that I mentioned earlier. The idea of the machine being something very recent. Tolkien connects the machine with orcs. He connects the machine with the creation of negative products like the ring that are meant to control things. One of Tom Bombadil's greatest powers and the source of so much of his ability is the fact he doesn't want to control things. He wants to leave things alone and in turn be left alone. And his sort of zen-like approach to life is fundamentally a contrast to everything we see in terms of the struggle for power of Middle-earth.
And the absolutely. Why do you think that Tolkien, I mean, there's only one Tom Bombadil. In the entire history of Middle-earth, there's one Tom Bombadil. Why does Tolkien bring him in? And if you had to, could you draw a line from Tom Bombadil back to the Silmarillion? And where he comes from, what he actually is.
Well, there are several theories about that. There's actually books written on this subject trying to work this out. There's the idea of what came before all of the creatures, really, that we see populating Middle-earth in the age of The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. If you go back and you see really what came before, you see the way that the first trees came into being, the first creatures, the hierarchy, essentially, of powers that had Middle-earth in their control, the Maiar, the way that they essentially created life and stepped back from life and let life happen. Yavanna, who is over the trees, for example, and the earth. You see that there's a sort of longer-lasting notion of stability and of permanence and of life always winning out over the creatures who want to in some way enslave it or corrupt it or twist it. And so I think Tom really represents this much, much, much earlier force. There's debates in terms of Tolkien's theology and such, how much you want to say. I mean, there are those who think Tom Bombadil is God. There are those who think, you know, the creator of everything who came down, that he's part of this very first song that was sung. He was the true harmony. I'm not sure that pinning it down doesn't, in a sense, diminish him, because part of Tom Bombadil is mystery. It's awe. It's wonder. It's the realization that just when you think you've got all of the hierarchies of who's the biggest and the baddest and the worst and the one to fear, there's someone else who completely upsets your apple cart and shows you that actually you didn't know half of what you thought you knew, that actually this is a much, much bigger scheme of things. And we are, in a sense, all very small hobbits in this much larger picture. And so the awe that he doesn't care about the ring, that you could be offering him power and dominion over everything, and absolutely doesn't tempt him at all. I think is part of the mystique about him. There's certain things that you could pull in terms of just very basic understanding of Tolkien's own writing. I mean, he wrote Tom Bombadil's stories to entertain his children, and there's a whole series of The Adventures of Tom Bombadil that didn't make it into The Lord of the Rings that you can read in his collected other stories. And in some way, just on a really unphilosophical level, he wanted to work in a favorite childhood character for his kids into this book.
Dr. Sturgis, I'm sure you're quite correct in that an awful lot of meaning people who discuss Tolkien, you know, we try to arrive at conclusions as to why he did this or why he did that. And in fact, you know, if Tolkien were alive today and on this line with us talking, he might say something like, you know, all I tried to do was write a fantasy. And so you're conjuring up an awful lot of things about my intention and motivation, but it really wasn't there, folks. I was just making a story. And sometimes I think we miss the forest for the trees. It's hard not to think in those. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. But there is, I think you're exactly right. There's a reason that we're drawn back to these characters, though. And I think Bombadil is one of the really important ones that that continues to capture us. And again, as I say, it's a favorite subject for my students' papers, because that's one of the things they all want to know. There's a reason that this is a mystery that grabs them and excites their imagination, because he still really does capture readers.
There's a part of the Bombadil section that I try to imagine what actually it might look like, and that's the scene when the hobbits first enter his house and Goldberry slams the door closed and throws her arms up across the back of it. I mean, it's almost a Sarah Bernhardt maneuver. It's like right off of a Hollywood set, you know. You got this picture of this gal whose arms go blasting across that door and telling him, heed no noises out there. You're well protected in here. Yeah, and I think I laugh every time I read it. Goldberry herself is a bit of a wonderment, because it's really kind of hard to even pin her down in terms of, you know, are we talking, what does it really mean, daughter of the river? Explain that a little bit from Tolkien's point of view.
You're right. She's another creature that we can't quite identify. We know that she's the river woman's daughter. We know that she, even though she has left the river, she needs the river, which is why he brings her water and he brings her the water lilies so that she can put her feet in them. She has a power of her a voice. She's, in a sense, very much a Mother Nature kind of creature. We don't really understand what she is in terms of species or race. And when we really pay attention to the description of Bombadil, it seems like they're a bit of an odd couple, because she's apparently quite
yeah,
lovely.
Yeah, definitely an odd couple.
Yes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Powerful in her own way, and in terms of women characters, she's one that stands out as having a list of powers that are really unique to her. And the fact that, you know, they didn't just come and see Tom; they spent time with her as well, and she gave them essentially the shelter and the blessing. Has a great deal to do with how they are able then to go on in their quest, in the same way that there are other really important women characters who play kind of the same role, who are unusual and who are unique to themselves, but also key contributors to this larger story. And each of them seems to have their own kind of mysterious background, but I think Goldberry is probably the most mysterious of those.
Dr. Sturgis, we are quickly running out of time here. I wish I had, you know, hours and hours. I'm going to have to close out, and you have the last word. It was great having you on. Give your last word to your students and the audience. What have you got to say?
Oh, well, it's been a delight speaking with you, and I hope everyone else is inspired as I am to go back and reread yet again. And I hope that if any of your listeners are interested in my work or in contacting me or finding out about more about what I write or teach, they'll look me up at amyhsturgis.com, my website. And I just really appreciate the chance to talk with you tonight.
Thank you, and you have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, folks, you've heard it, and it's time to wrap up. I know we were running a little late. Don gave me a few more minutes, but we are quickly bumping up against the hour. Have to close out. This is Nevin Campanella thanking you for listening, and I wish all of you a wonderful day. That's a wrap, Don.